Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Sarah Pascoe.
Hello, I'm Carrie Adloyd.
And we're weird about books.
We love to read.
We read too much.
We talk too much.
About the too much that we've read.
Which is why we've created
The Weirdos Book Club.
Join us!
A space for the lonely outsider to feel accepted and appreciated.
A place for the person who'd love to be in a real book club but doesn't like wine or nibbles.
Or being around other people.
Is that you? Join us.
Check out our Instagram at Sarah and Carrie Ads Weirdos Book Club for the upcoming books we're going to be discussing.
You can read along
and share your opinions.
Or just skulk around in your raincoat like the weirdo you are.
Thank you for reading with us. We like reading with you.
This week's book guest is Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma by Claire Dederer.
What's it about?
It's a non-fiction walk through all the art monsters of our times, from Polanski to Woody Allen to Miles Davis.
What qualifies it for the Weirdos Book Club? Well, monsters are just weirdos turned bad.
In this episode, we discuss
art,
nuance,
red dwarf,
power,
zero tolerance,
and feeling earthy.
And joining us this week is Winnie M. Lee. Winnie is a lauded novelist. Her first novel, A Dark Chapter, won Guardian Book of the Year. Her most recent, Complicit, was released in 2022 to much acclaim, and her new novel is coming in 2025.
Trigger warning, in this episode, we discuss rape, abuse, anti-Semitism, and racism.
Hi, Winnie!
Hello, hi guys!
I'm so excited to talk about this book. Which yes. makes it seem like I haven't been excited to talk about the other books.
No, but this is not, I feel like, this is big for me and you because Claire Dederer, who is, I don't, that well known here, I don't feel. She's an author.
It's not
an essayist.
Like saying like Jilly Cooper.
It's not like
we feel we discovered Claire Dederer by accident.
We read her
earlier
book.
You did. You discovered her.
Love and Trouble.
And then you recommended it to me.
Her. You recommended it to me, didn't you?
Did I?
No memory from both of us.
Anyway, Someone recommended it.
She wrote a book called Love and Trouble, which we felt like, we were the only people, like it was hard to get hold of.
Right.
And then no one else seemed to have read it. And it was kind of a memoir of her life, just like being married, walking around a lake, talking to her friends.
So crying all the time.
Crying all
That's
the time.
That's why we loved it. Yeah. It was about getting to an age, and I don't know if it was 40s. It might have been 50s and more about sort of menopausal hormones, but essentially like just it. Weeping all the time and not knowing why, and then speaking right. to your friends and they're weeping all the time as well.
Yeah.
So, that's what, so we loved it.
So we knew Claire Dederer from that, and then we found out that she was writing Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma, which is about the art monsters of the past century, really, and this century. And we got very excited. We've covered a lot of fiction on this podcast, but I feel like this... It's such a good book. We just wanted to talk about it.
Yeah. And we wanted to talk to you about
it. Yes, it fits
because there's
into
such
your...
a cross-section of topics with your own writing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because I think this book came out last year and obviously it's got like a brilliant cover, right? And you're like, what is this cover, right? But then I remember seeing the buzz about it and being like, oh, no, that's like right in my wheelhouse.
Yeah,
in terms
yes.
of things that I study, but it's a non-fictional take on it.
Yes.
Yeah. So it kind of addresses all the issues I sort of wanted to be hinting at or addressing in my fiction.
Yes. So I read it alongside Complicit and... It felt like two sides. It felt like one person is dealing with the thing that's made the product and how we feel about that morally. And Complicit was so much about how so many people are around making something like a movie. So Polanski didn't make it by himself.
Right.
You know, there's a whole group of people around.
So,
and how all of them are complicit or responsible for a tiny little thing. And what are people aware of? And then personally, if you've been around someone like that, I mean... You're not just watching their work.
And Complicit is your second fiction.
Yeah.
Yes, you say. Yeah. Which is about, someone working next to a kind of Weinstein figure, I suppose you could say.
Weinstein, Epstein. Yeah. But British, a British version of that.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you for making it.
Yeah. And Claire is, she starts with Polanski. That's kind of how she gets into this art.
Because that's who she loves.
That's her, the one that she shouldn't like anymore, but she can't quit.
Yeah, so that's the thing,
isn't
it? I
just can't quit Polanski.
It's feeling that you shouldn't because you know something that they've done. So I wanted to ask if either of you have a monster.
I do, and she discusses my monster, which I very much appreciated.
Who's that?
David Bowie.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So I have a big, big thing about David Bowie, which, like, and it's about grief, guys. What a surprise. So my dad died when I was a teenager, and what's quite common if you lose a parent when you're younger is you kind of invent this person who's sort of like your mum or dad in public.
Do you sort of project onto
someone? You project, because it's like they're still there and they look a bit like your dad. There's something about them that reminds you of the parent you've lost, but it feels like, oh, they're still there. So I did that with David Bowie. It was like, well, my dad is dead, but David Bowie's still there, because my dad loved David Bowie. So when she talks about, I love the bit that she talks about on David.
She's very defensive of David Bowie.
She's talking about people from Roman Polanski, Woody Allen, Miles Davis, David Bowie. She covers all of these monsters and the relationship that we have with people that we love their work despite knowing some bad stuff about them. So when I started hearing, oh, David Bowie sat with all these groupies, I was like, la, 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 no, not David. We got to that point in you know, whenever it was a couple of years ago, and you were like, is no one safe?
Yeah,
has everybody been just sleeping with 15-year-old girl? Like, who hasn't been doing that?
But isn't that interesting that that's where we got to? There's no one, probably. We can just, with impunity, go, I absolutely know that they didn't do anything that I wouldn't find morally unsound. And it's come full circle to now we can write books about how it's okay to like those people, even if they did those things.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is why I love this book, because I love that I think, I don't know how you feel, Willie, that she's not proffering an answer. She's just discussing. That's how I, like, the big thing really is, what do we do about this? And I do feel like she's not like, this is right or this is wrong. It's kind of like, it's hard. It's hard because they create this great work that we love, or we feel, what she says about David Bowie is like, the weirdos need him. Those teenagers need him. And that's how I felt. Like, he was like the only person offering this, oh, there's this life where you can be weird and strange and it's okay. And then when someone's like, oh yeah, but did you know he did this? You're like, then.
Winnie, I didn't find out if you had a monster.
Yeah, who's your monster?
I mean, it probably is Michael Jackson.
Oh, right. Okay. Interesting.
And that's really, really problematic. Obviously, the whole point of this whole book is like some artists are problematic because, I mean, his music is so good.
It's so good.
She talks about how everyone's like, his music is so good and he was a pioneer. And yet at the same time, you know about all these things that you've done. So it's, you know, there's still Michael Jackson musicals, which are making huge amounts of money on stage. Like, you know, his estate is probably raking in, you know, all those royalties. And so I think in some ways it's easier to say, okay, this person's now dead, so they themselves are not benefiting financially from me enjoying their art, right? And so that's a problem with Polanski and Woody Allen, because they're all still alive. But at the same time, it's like, okay, but I do want to enjoy his music, and I can, like, I still, you know, but at the same time, I know what he's done, and there's that creepiness. And so she talks about the stain, about how, like, once you know that someone's been doing this, it just really kind of, like, ruins your enjoyment, or it kind of is there at the edges.
I thought that was really well described, that, Michael Jackson, a song comes on and your body responds before you respond intellectually, because
that's the thing with Michael Jackson, like, it will take you a while before you're like, oh, wait, hang on, this is Michael Jackson.
But the fact that you are literally your toes tapping, or maybe you're actually dancing or singing along, and then you remember what he did. So,
and her argument of having to keep re-remembering. Is Jackson 5 okay? But like, later Michael's not okay.
Exactly,
like, what can you like get down to? Like, ABC might be all right because he didn't know what he was doing, but he was also being abused by his father at that point.
So
complicated.
And also, I mean, because it's hard not to, on some level, you know, really appreciate what he's done as an artist in terms of like, all, you know, as a black working class kid from the middle of America, like, what, okay, admittedly it was his father who masterminded the whole thing, but the amount of work, the hard work, and absolute dedication to reach his level of craft, so you do admire that, and you admire the music itself, but then his actual personal life is so fraught. And I think there's a distinction between, you know, artists that we see on screen, like Michael Jackson, like Friend, and his whole thing about I love the children in different ways, right?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
you know, in his very public thing of I love the children.
Yeah.
And then seeing that kind of very, you know, that very visual person in your mind versus somebody like Polanski, who's kind of, he's not on screen, right? Woody Allen is on screen, but there are some people that certain kinds of artists, depending on the art they make, kind of like are behind the screens and they're allowed to kind of be a bit more laconic and you don't know as much about their personal life versus somebody who puts up this very, you know, public front, which is in complete odds with the way they're acting behind the stage.
That was a very interesting section towards the end of the book. I think it's around page 80 where she's talking about direct address in broadcasting. Even though your awareness that you are one of an audience, someone can speak directly to you and the ramifications that has then on their actions. And you're absolutely right. People who loved and love Michael Jackson, he was one of those artists where it's like, oh, he's my person. He was the person representing me, the person I wanted to be, the person you would be a child and go, if he managed to get everything.
Well, she talks about the magic of performing, doesn't she? Like, and the magic trick, speaking to an individual versus a crowd, she talks about. And like, how many times have you seen a good performer and you've said, it's like they were talking to me? Like, I remember seeing Beyonce in concert before... like the big
but she was like, Carrie, you're an amazing dancer,
she shouted it out and that, it was just me and her and I think it was a dream. I remember
she's
seeing,
like, Jay-Z, get out the car, Carrie Ann's coming with me to Pizza Express.
I need a backing dancer. Okay. I guess I could, I've got my trainers on, but sure. I saw her, I remember it was like massive Wembley, something like that, and that was I was like, oh my god, like, and this is, I want to say this is like pre, this is like Crazy in Love times, this is before we all knew that she was a certified actual goddess walking around amongst us. And I was like, whoa, this is like, we had bad seats, we were far away, and I was like, I feel like she's singing to me. This isn't, and I was like, oh, this is what people talk about. And that you know, that's again which comes up so much with Art Monsters, is like, that's a power, right? A power that some performers have, some producers have, some writers have, that they feel like they are talking directly to you. One of the really interesting people I think she talks about is J.K. Rowling. Like, I found that, as again someone who was into Harry Potter, but We both read Harry Potter, but we're a bit older.
We were adults when the book came out.
We weren't quite like the Potterhead generation, but I would have been.
But
absolutely.
We did queue for the second book.
I queued for that second book. I went to Tesco with my mum, drove me to Tesco in Edgeware so I could get it at midnight.
I was already at university, and the excitement of it and the excitement of going to see the film, maybe that's what was university. I felt like I was part of history. I wept during the credits.
Oh, the films always upset me.
I don't have that same.
Like, in the books, there is an actual sorting hat that sorts you into a category and says, like, you are this person and you are this person, and you feel part of a group.
From what's in your heart.
What's in your heart.
You can see what's inside you.
No wonder, like, it appeals to every teenage vulnerability, those books. And, like, I love
absolutely.
Those books.
Because it's not about what you've done, it's about what you could do. So that the idea of like courage, like you could save your friend, you just haven't saved your friend yet.
Haven't done it yet.
As a teenager, you're like, I know I'm worth something.
Yeah. But she talks about when, you know, JK comes out with the anti-trans stance that she does, like the betrayal in the queer community that these kids thought this was a book, which was about, it doesn't matter who you are, whatever's in your heart, there's this goodness, the difference is welcomed. And that thing of... I find it interesting because I'm not only into Harry Potter, I'm into Lord of the Rings. And like, we don't live at a time where Tolkien could be tweeting. Like, Tolkien could have been tweeting any old stuff.
He probably wouldn't be into that.
So he's another anti-Semitic one, isn't he?
He's definitely up there. And it's that thing of being so close to the author these days. Like you said, so there's a generation where, like, you know, Michael Jackson is public facing because he's a pop star. But now we're in this generation where writers and producers and all these people, we're so much closer to them, and we can see and hear what they think. And you know, it's that weird thing of going, well, is it good that we know that J.K. Rowling thinks these? And then what does that do to reading, to wanting to read the books, to enjoying the books? And I love that she's coming from the point of view of an audience and a fan of, like, the moral quandary, the tension isn't in the writer, it's in the person who's reading it going, oh, I like it, but you said a bad thing.
Have you ever then, either of you, liked someone's work until you found out what they did and then gone off it? Because with comedy, stand-up comedians, quite often, you know, you've seen a DVD growing up or, you know, really like someone's work and then you meet them and they're rude, even just rude, okay? So I'm not saying monstrous behaviour, I'm saying antisocial slightly. And then the next time you see them, I'm like,
Yeah.
And you don't laugh with them anymore. You don't see the twinkle in their eye. You don't think, oh, I'd love to go for a beer with them.
I don't have it with stand-up. I have it because I was so obsessed with like watching comedy as a kid. Mm. So like comedy actors who like I had seen, and I would like follow people's careers. So I would see like, oh, they were in that episode of Red Dwarf and now they're in this episode of British Empire. Like, oh my God. And like,
I know, Karen, you're really outing yourself now.
I'm not even outing. Captain Hollister, you who went, is in episode one.
What is she talking about?
Beyonce's cancelled the tour.
But I mean, to be fair, there's like different levels of monster.
Yes.
Film, right?
Which
I mean,
is
that really
it,
a monster? Because I mean, it's one thing to be Polanski or doing what Michael Jackson was doing or Weinstein. And it's another
being
thing
being a bit snippy to me and Sarah on a job. Yeah, I agree with you. Exactly. That is not the same.
And then like in between you have, you know, J.K. Rowling, who some people see as a monster because of her views on trans, and Virginia Woolf, who some people see as a monster because she said some anti-Semitic things or wrote some anti-Semitic things. And I'd say like they're not in the same category as Polanski and Cosby. And then there's a really interesting thing, kind of like the second half of the book is really about, is it a monster to be a female artist and abandon your children?
Yes.
And not abandon them flat out, although some people do that, but also just not be there as a mother.
But this will be a battle. If you're working, you're not with your kids. And if you're with your kids, you're not working. And if you are a writer, which you two both are, then to have that seesaw, I thought that was, I think that's why I got so excited about this book coming out, is that when I read the extract, it was that bit, which is about monstrousness and questioning your own monstrousness. And I'm going to read you the quote, actually, because I just thought this was so brilliant. I have to wonder, maybe I'm not monstrous enough, but a little part of me has to ask, if I were more selfish, would my work be better? Mm. Should I aspire to greater selfishness? Every writer mother I know has asked herself this question.
Yeah, yeah. But there's, I mean, again, different levels of monsterdom, because she's saying, am I being a monster because I'm so dedicated to my art? I'm not there 100% for my kids all the time. Versus people like, you know, Polanski or David Bowie, who, you know, maybe they were monsters in the process of making their art, but have achieved a certain level of stardom, and that enabled or pardoned or gave them access to doing these things with young girls, right? I mean, so it's almost like as a result of their stardom, they've been pardoned for their monstrous behavior. They feel like they can.
Yeah, and she
says
that with Picasso and Hemingway as well. Yeah. I thought that chapter is really interesting, where she's like, they allowed their genius to become part of the myth, which meant, well, if we want their genius art, their paintings and their books, we must put up with their beating their wives constantly or burning a cigarette into a woman's cheek because that's art. What's really
that's a genius.
Yeah, that's genius.
They're unstable, so we can't expect of them.
But I think the gender is really interesting because what she talks about is, for a man to be a monstrous artist, he is like, he abuses his power. Mm-hmm. But for a woman to be a monstrous artist, it is like not being a good mother. I love that she says, like, I am the accuser and I want to consume the art. That's the bit that I think is this tension of like, we're pointing the finger at people. And she talks about cancel culture, which, you know, is talked about a lot, and the lack of nuance. And like you said, like everything you're saying, you're like, it's really complicated. Like, every case has to be reviewed in a way. And, you know, from Wagner to Bill Cosby to J.K. Rowling, like, everybody's crimes are so different and so complex. And yet here we are on social media or, you know, on a podcast trying to be like, well, this person's okay, so you can watch that film, but not that song.
But it's about how it affects other people. So if I was wearing an I Love Wagner t-shirt, that would have an effect on the people I was around.
That's true.
If you have a radio show, if you're DJing, Winnie, and you stick Michael Jackson song, purely Michael Jackson hits, some people are going to go, well, I'm not enjoying the disco.
Yeah, so it's a kind of thing about what can you publicly be seen to be embracing and what can you privately enjoy.
Well, she says, isn't she, like, the guilt of sitting down to stream a Roman Polanski film, you know, like feeling, even in your own home, of like, oh, it's for research, that's why I'm watching it. And then watching Chinatown and being like, God, this is incredible. Like, this is such a good film. But being like, ah, I don't want to think these things. But people can be talented and awful. And I think that's what we're fighting all the time, of like, how people are not one thing. It's not a binary. Like, they can be artistic geniuses and absolute abusers. But we've made that almost hand in hand, that the man must be a genius and an abuser, and that's okay.
Right.
Like, how do we find a path to be an artist and not abuse, be an abuser?
With really monstrous behaviour, We are looking for clues about how does a person do that, because we can't imagine doing it.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Murdering someone, grooming someone.
Straight to me, though.
Murdering
someone.
Someone who says Red Dwarf isn't that good, Max.
Whoa.
No, no, No one said it. No one said it.
I mean, series 7 to 8. Yes, I agree with you. But series 1 to 5 are absolute classics.
I mean, there is something to be said. And like, I don't know how much Claire brings this up in her book. I mean, so for me, one, the main reason to separate art from the artist is because for every single amazing artist that's made it out there and who's seen as a star, there are loads and loads of other really talented artists that are never going to get that chance. And maybe, who knows, maybe are even more talented, but because they never got those opportunities, because we know
Shakespeare's sister argument, and also the Hannah Gadsby and her brilliant show, where she's like, who else didn't get there?
Yeah, so we know these industries aren't fair industries. So if somebody makes it, I feel, okay, fine, great, I want to see that other, whatever art that person creates next, but that's not a pardon to then, you know, to be committing these crimes, because there's loads of other people out there who are really talented, who aren't abusers, who aren't criminals, who I think generally are maybe women.
But that's what's interesting, is that we've linked the two. Mm. We've made it like, well, if you do the great art, maybe you will be an arsehole. Like, we've made that like part of the pack of cards you need to be the great artist. And if we do meet someone who's nice, we're like, oh, they're actually nice. Like, people say that all the time about famous people, like, oh no, they're actually all right. Like, isn't that weird that they're famous, talented, and nice?
In Complicit, when you go to great lengths to talk about Sarah's background and the background of all of the people sort of working in the film industry.
The character of Sarah. It sounded like you're talking about yourself.
Oh, yes. The character of Sarah, the connections and, the intersection between class, money, education, racial background.
If you're an outsider, if you're not white, for example, and you're growing up in the West, or if you're working class, you know, you just don't have access to those circles. So to grow up in a kind of an immigrant community and say, I want to be a writer, I want to be an actor, like that's a huge amount of work you have to do to get there, right? And so once you're there, there's almost an expectation, like, it's for the same reason that, like, you know, Barack Obama, when he was elected president of the US, he's not going to be having affairs on the side, right? Mm-hmm. Because his role as a black man in a very public position was one where he had to be like absolutely upstanding morally, right? Mm-hmm. And there couldn't be any kind of behavior on his end that would attract attention. So same thing, if you're from a background where you're already an outsider, once you reach that level of some kind of platform, you have to be on your best behavior, in a sense that you should be on your best behavior because you're lucky to have even attained that position.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody who's already, you know, who comes from money, who comes from privilege, and somehow like finds themselves in this, who's maybe a Nepo baby, who finds himself in this position, you know, maybe they already come from a world where they're allowed to act like that. And so there isn't that additional layer of you have to be on your best behavior and you have to be, you know, not, you know, we have to be respecting people's sexual consent, for example. You have to be not an alcoholic, right? Because you're aware of how far you've gone, how hard you've had to work to get there, I suppose. So, yeah. And so I think that distinction between privilege and entitlement, and so I guess entitlement's another way to say it, whereas, you know, and people often say there's a gendered element to it because men feel like they're entitled to different things, right? So, and that's like runs throughout pretty much every industry we can think of, right?
Yeah.
Whereas women have to work a lot harder to be taken seriously, to get that book deal, you know, to get that, you know, those venues booked for that show. So you're not going to do anything to endanger that.
No, and actually there would be a huge amount of introspection of, am I behaving in a way which is going to, you know, allow my work to continue? There would be a constant checking in with herself. I don't know a woman who wouldn't in her quiet moments go, oh gosh, do they not like me? They don't seem to be responding well to me. That boss seems to have been disappointed with my work today. That kind of
thing. The constant, how can I make everybody like me so that I'm allowed to stay in the room? I think a lot of women can relate to that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So even that sense of freedom, like, so there's some kind of anxiety, I suppose, that happens, you know, once you reach that level of position, because you're like, oh, yeah, no, I can't afford to screw this up, right? Mm. Or I have to always be creating work that pleases people or pleases the gatekeepers. Whereas I feel like men oftentimes, especially if you look at people like Hemingway or, you know, Picasso, they're just given that license to like do whatever they want, act however they want, because they're that confident in their themselves as an artist or themselves as a genius.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What you're saying very clearly is if you have always been establishment, and it's something she does reference sort of
John Cleese argument. Yeah, I might quote that. It's so good. But I feel like she's so clear on
if you've
this
always
argument.
Been the establishment, you think that your voice, you would never question that you're representative of everyone.
So yeah. She's talking about in 2018, Shane Allen. I love that Shane Allen gets a shout out in this book. It was like suddenly a character we knew. Yeah. He's not anymore. He was the BBC comedy controller.
What does she call him?
The laughs czar.
Because
she's obviously like, what? Mm. So Shane Allen said, if you're going to assemble a team now, it's not going to be six Oxbridge white blokes. He was referring to Monty Python, which obviously annoyed Monty Python, and Terry Gilliam responded vehemently. I no longer want to be a white male. I don't want to be blamed for everything wrong in the world. I tell the world now I'm a black lesbian. Thank you, Mr. Gilliam.
Sure, the black lesbians love that. Also, we will welcome you into the fold.
Thanks, Terry.
They've already had all the stuff. It's not like retrospectively we're taking it away.
Everything about it is irritating.
Yeah.
And then John Cleese accused Mr. Allen of social engineering. Just the old men, just shush. Anyway, she says, much better than that, she says, but of course, giving a group of white male fancy pantses all the breaks for years is the ultimate social engineering. Listen, I'd rather watch the Pythons than Gadsby any day of the week. But the point is this, none of these guys has the bandwidth to even entertain the idea that a woman or a person of colour's point of view might just be as normal as theirs, just as central. They seem incapable of understanding that theirs is not the universal point of view and that their own comedy has left people out.
Yeah.
And that, I read that and I was like, oh, it's such a clear argument of like, what they're saying is like, oh, we're getting the blame for everything. It's like, You in being all white men doing all panel shows and all comedy, you left everyone out.
Yeah.
But to them, they're like, but we didn't know. And it's like,
we can all enjoy me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And this is my argument. I remember growing up, I watched a lot of male comedy. So I learned really quickly. It's funny when women moan. It's funny when men don't pick up their clothes. It's funny. Like, I had to learn that.
Women never say yes to sex. You have to keep asking them.
And it's really annoying. And I remember watching, you know, stuff like Red Dwarf, which actually is pretty progressive, guys.
I think you've mentioned it enough times. We're gonna check.
Are you
it
sure?
Out
okay.
What is this Red Dwarf?
I want them to remake it again and put me in as Kachansky. But listen, I remember learning. Oh, this is what men find funny, but women. I remember when Broad City came out, which is American comedy with two women in the lead, Alana Glazer and Abby Jacobson. And I remember watching it laughing and talking to someone at the BBC who said, oh, it's a bit vulgar. Because the first episode is like they're storing weed up their vaginas, basically. And I remember thinking, oh, you haven't had to learn how women sometimes do things. Like, you haven't had to sit down and watch women be funny. Whereas we privately have watched women be funny and have their own. But we've had to. And that's the thing with this argument of the white male Pythons being like, well, but we are normal. And therefore now we're being told off for being normal. Not seeing how centered that is.
The gendered response to the consumption of the work of monsters.
I feel like I've mentioned Red Dwarf too much.
I thought was so. I've not read anyone else talking about it or even talked to people about it. But that thing where maybe one myself doesn't enjoy work anymore because of a man's biography and thinks it's done, and then a man tells you that's the wrong response.
Oh, when she talks about Woody Allen, I've had to deal with that, because if you like Woody Allen, you've ever had a conversation about men love telling you you're
being
wrong
told
about that.
It's not about what he's did, it's about the work, as if you've done something wrong. And I love her defense of like, you can't, just like you can't choose whether your toe is tapping to Michael Jackson, you can't choose if you something doesn't speak to you anymore because of what you know, if the biography interrupting.
Well, she talks about you having an emotional reaction, and she was like, the men are acting like, oh no, Woody Allen is a genius, you just have to ignore what he did, like as if that isn't emotional.
I mean, she kind of says, like, as a fan, like anybody, it's really about two biographies, meaning the biography of the artist and the biography of like you yourself. So if you've experienced sexual abuse or you know, and you know that this has been done by an artist, then that's a kind of clash between your own personal experience and what this other person has done, and you can't enjoy the work anymore. And that's not something that other people who haven't experienced sexual abuse have to worry about, right, in the same way. So, which is probably why so many men are like, oh, well, that's fine, whatever Woody Allen did, because they never were on the receiving end.
We have a really huge conversation in comedy, and it goes on sort of every year, it's getting updated, but about jokes about rape.
Yeah.
And the thing is that you don't, that thing about biographies meeting, you have no idea who is in your audience and what they've experienced.
Exactly,
and actually, you have to make certain assumptions. A certain amount of your audience will have experienced cancer, either firsthand or for a family member. Some of them, you know, one in 10 of them will be diabetic. You're like, there's all these sort of things you make assumptions. And there's sensitivity from some people that talking about something like sexual assault is going to, is your material worth the emotional response from people who have experienced something? And a lot of the time the answer is no. Now, sometimes, like Gatsby's show is a great example. Yeah. Sorry, I just hate it when anyone's mean about anyone.
I did think it was unnecessary to throw Gatsby under the bus
Gatsby
at that point.
Gatsby became so massive that she then became this, oh, she just had to absorb so much criticism.
Yeah,
and it's just so mean.
Well, there's no, you can't, Pythons to Gatsby, it's not a comparison. That's,
and also, it's not a choice. You can enjoy, you can have both.
Yeah,
or,
exactly.
Or neither.
Exactly, yeah.
I hate people being mean.
Sorry, Claire, that's our one complaint.
I was just imagining Hannah Gadsby settling down for
being like,
so Gadsby's show includes references to assault, in particular, you know, her own experiences. And I wouldn't say you can't ever talk about rape in comedy, because that would then mean Gadsby can't perform that show.
Yeah.
But when there are men making very lazy jokes, is that worth? And trying to explain to people to empathize.
I mean, you can have experienced it and also make jokes about it in a way that still kind of honor or respect the trauma. I suppose in the same way that a lot of, you know, black comedians will joke about black culture, about you know, about race and everything like that. But it's almost like, okay, no, they're allowed to because they've lived through it, right?
Yes.
Whereas if you were, you know, a white man, you certainly can't be joking about race in the same day these days. Or if you're a white man who's never experienced, you know, who's never been on the receiving end of sexual violence, abuse, harassment, it's probably not okay to be joking about that. And it probably never was, but for decades, it always was.
That's one of the bits I really enjoyed, where she talks about Wagner and she references a Stephen Fry documentary where he wants to go back and speak to Wagner. And she really pulls out all the really solid evidence of like, oh, Wagner absolutely knew what he was doing when he wrote his essay, like, you know, against Jews in general in music. And she said, you know, we forgive the past, and we give this like, oh, they didn't know things were different then. And she's like, oh, he knew so badly, he wrote this essay to be like, oh, look, I know you think it's okay to like Jews, but here's me explaining to you why it's definitely not okay.
Right.
And I thought that was really interesting, that we're constantly, again, that argument of like, oh, things were different then. I mean, classic, I know this is such a classic, but when the Me Too happened, I remember talking to my mum about it, and her friend was like, oh, I mean, who didn't get their bottom pinched in those, you know, things were different. Like, that was her friend's instant argument. I was like, that doesn't mean it's okay. Just because things happened, or men were allowed to write essays where they said Jewish, all these awful anti-Semitic things, it doesn't mean that they didn't know what they were doing.
And it doesn't mean they wouldn't be doing it exactly the same now.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you can't say that if you did, I mean, no one would make this movie, but if Wagner was in a time travel machine, he wouldn't instantly realise the error of his ways.
Well, this is what she's saying, isn't she, with Wagner? Of like, we like to say, oh, well, if I was there, I would have been different as well. And I think, again, that's a really interesting argument, because we are currently living through hideous, hideous things, and people are going, well, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, how do you? And you can see how hard it is to make this an active part of your life, where you're fighting wrong at every turn, and literally get up and exist and eat and shower and do all the things you need to do to be a human.
Winnie, I think you, in Complicit show, because I think lots of people would hear about a monster working, say, in Hollywood, and think, but how does nobody know, how is it allowed to happen? And what you showed so brilliantly, and if anyone is ever wondering that, they should read your book, is that people have a sort of an idea or a hint, or maybe see someone crying, but they are concentrating on, you know, mostly themselves, their huge workload, their own stresses, and getting on, and everyone knows a tiny little bit, and no one else is responsible, because they aren't the monsters themselves.
Yeah.
But you can end up with a huge amount of people who knew a tiny little bit, and then when it comes out, why didn't you do something? Well, based on what? I saw a woman crying on the stairs.
Mm. Yeah, and also if you're working under that monster, so if there's a person who is abusive, who's a bully in the workplace, and you know there are many, and you can make the argument that to have reached a certain level of success in these industries, maybe you have to be a bit of an asshole, right? You know, let's be honest about that. Whether, you know, whether it's a director or whether you're a producer, you know, I mean, there is a certain kind of like psychotic behavior in terms of pursuing success to that level. So, you know, if you're working under someone like that, no, you don't want to get them angry, right? So I can imagine, I mean, like, you know, Weinstein was not a good person to work for because he was well-connected, but he was constantly kind of shouting at people, right? So, you know, if he says, like, set up a meeting with me and this young woman in a hotel room and that's your job, you know, who were you to say, actually, should you be doing that, Harvey, right? Because you're just going to be, like, shouted at, right? And then you'll lose your job and you'll probably never work in the industry again. Yeah. So it's that level of power that people have.
And Weinstein was one of the people who did try and, he did end careers. He did end actresses' careers.
Absolutely. Yeah,
people who did question him did stop working. Yeah. Yeah. So people had evidence. They weren't imagining the ramifications.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Rose McGowan, you know, in her book, she recounts how she was abused, I mean, basically raped by Harvey in Sundance, right? And then she told her agents and they were just like, oh, just don't mention it again, right? You know, and so they kind of like were like, just, you know, we'll just bury this.
And that's a different kind of monstrousness.
Yeah.
And it is a kind of monster, and that's what your character has to examine in themselves.
Yeah.
Is, and I think that would be true of those agents.
Yeah.
I mean, if they thought they were giving her good career advice or something, but you would have to question.
But it is very much like everybody for themselves, because like, okay, I'm going to, you know, this is the best thing for your career, my client, right? But then let's forget about all the other women out there who might be abused because we're saying nothing, right?
Yeah.
And so again, with Sarah, because she comes from, you know, an immigrant background, her parents run a Chinese restaurant and she feels lucky to even have this in the industry. She doesn't want to do anything that's going to endanger her position. And then again, she has like there's a very definite power structure, both of her bosses, she's kind of scared of, right?
Yeah. And she's told she's replaceable.
Yeah, that sense that you're expendable and you're lucky to have this job. And so if you're not okay with this, then get out, because there's 10,000 other people that want your job, right? I mean, there's an interesting thing, because there's a female boss in Complicit, Sylvia, who is, you know, she's in her 50s, so she's kind of this like sort of battle-worn, you know, hard-nosed woman who kind of has this like ambivalent role, because on one hand she takes Sarah under her wing and says like, oh no, I'll mentor you and give you these opportunities, but she's also blind, or she just kind of decides not to really engage with the fact
she thinks she's a realist, doesn't she understands that, you know, the character Hugo, who's the abuser or the main abuser, it's sort of like, he's the money, so that's what happens.
Yeah.
You keep him happy. And the director is the genius, so he says sexist things, and you keep him happy.
Yeah.
And her age actually is her sort of defense. Of like, I've been around, this is what happens.
Yeah, and that goes back to a bit to what you were saying in terms of, okay, a generational thing, like, oh, well, back in the day, we all had to deal with this, right? You know, I mean, being pinched under the bum or being called this by a man, like, that's just what you have to deal with as a woman in the industry. And just saying, like, well, I had to put up with it when I was a young woman, so you girls should buck up too.
Yeah.
And that kind of like quite hardened, like really cynical attitude, which still pardons that kind of behavior, and in some ways doesn't really protect young women either, because
it's a really interesting, isn't it? Because I agree with you, it pardons it and it offers no protection.
Yeah.
It's really is a victim who's saying, I'm fine. Like, I'm fine. There's no acknowledgement of like, oh yeah, that hurt me and I was upset and I feel really, it's like all of those feelings are deep buried.
I'm fine now.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't happen to me anymore.
Or like, I decided not to be affected by it. And again, it's like this thing with monstrousness of like, you a pinch on the bum is one thing, but being sexually assaulted by your boss is completely different. Like, you know, the layers
or
of
hearing abuse. Being around someone and hearing him say things. And then when it comes out, they have actually done things, going, well, I only heard.
Yeah. Or you see, you know, we've all been in a position where you've like heard the joke and everyone's laughed and you've walked away going, oh, that was a really gross joke. But like, it was a joke and everyone was okay. Everyone just laughed. Like, how near you are to the bomb blast of what the actual monstrousness is.
But it's that kind of sliding scale of what we'll tolerate as well, right?
Yeah.
So we'll tolerate guys saying this or pinching your bum, and if you're already giving them that kind of radius to do that, then that enables other behavior on their end, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's this kind of like blindness you put up just to kind of protect your own career, but there's no kind of structural change happening there, right? So like in Complicit, there's quite a few different female characters who are all quite strong women in their own way. And because some of them are older and they're in different positions within the industry, you know, one of them is an up-and-coming actress who, like, 10 years later is now an A-list actress, right? But she's in a very vulnerable position with the Weinstein-type character with Hugo. But, you know, and she becomes quite good friends with Sarah, but then even though Sarah suspects something might have happened to the other actress, to that actress, like, they don't talk about it. Actor, she's using the term actor. So there's this kind of, like, silence that happens. And because women aren't sharing their stories with each other, or because people aren't talking openly about it, that allows the abuse to continue. Yeah. And so Sarah kind of is very regretful about, you know, she never spoke up, and therefore there might be hundreds of other women since then that have experienced that, and whose careers and lives were, you know, permanently affected. And, you know, did I play a part in that because I didn't speak up at the time?
Mm. I mean, I thought it was interesting in this book, Monsters, when she talks about the Me Too movement. And Kelly Oxford's one of Kelly Oxford's tweets, where it's like, okay, I'll go first. You know, I'm 12 and a guy does that, grabs my ass on the bus. Like, that was my first. And then, like, the amount, like, the millions and millions of responses were this sort of, this global moment where everyone was like, oh, that wasn't okay. Because, like you said, we've all experienced those things, or all, like, the small things that permit another worse thing that you do brush off, and you do think, and all of us, most of women, it's like, yeah, I was 12, I was 13, I was 11.
And our silence, for whatever reasons, you know, embarrassment, self-blame, or feeling it's so uniform, you don't have shouts about the time, that it meant that a lot of men were in shocking disbelief. Women were not shocked.
No.
Right. Women were like, yes. And or the opposite, where they go, how can this be true? It's happened. There was like an essay in the Times from an older man being like, but if these statistics are true, this means it happened to everyone. they must be exaggerated, because that made more sense to him, that the statistics were made up than experience.
You get the same experience when, you know, when something, when we, with the Black Lives Matter movement, like that white movement being like, what? Oh my God, this is
why
awful.
Didn't you tell us?
And then the whole community being like, this happens to every, why are you shocked? And we've been like, oh, that's not my experience. I don't face it day to day. I'm not seeing it.
Or you've tried to tell me and I haven't absorbed it.
Or just you're not living in those, you're not walking in those shoes. Yeah. And so you're just not seeing it in the same way. And I feel like we are living in this very amazing moment where, you know, especially in this industry, I mean, to be fair, it's any industry. It's not just the film industry, the comedy industry. Yeah. Like, all industries have people who abuse their power.
It happens in supermarkets.
Yeah,
it's
and not, I, that
it's
also
not just
annoys
glitzy,
us when they're like,
parties.
Why is the comedy industry so bad? You're like, I've been sexually harassed at all sorts of jobs.
Like industries, there are men there. Sorry.
But yeah, I think, like, we are living in this amazing point where, like you said, people suddenly share the stories, and then suddenly we realise, oh, this is a problem, there is a culture. And I just think, I like the way she describes it as a book about broken hearts.
Mm. Yeah.
And like, there's that quote, so she's talking about, she lives in Seattle, it's quite a small community, and there was some people in the Seattle, like, rock community who end up being like arseholes. And this teen, she calls her crepe girl, she's like making pancakes, doesn't she? And she says, oh, I still love them, even after everything. Mm. And she was like, that is all of us. Like, even after everything, there's this piece of you that loves this thing. And I love, towards the end of the book, she starts, really, I think the end of that last bit is basically what the whole book about, is like, why do we love people who are awful? Like, why do you, not just Michael Jackson, David Bowie, J.K. Rowling, boyfriends, uncle, like people who have hurt and abused you, yet you still feel love for them. And that's why I think this book is so interesting, because it's getting into the nuance of humanity, that you, even though you know things, you can still love
imperfect people.
You love imperfect people.
And she quotes all through the book, re-quoting Woody Allen, who is also re-quoting, but the heart wants what it wants.
Oh, Emily Dickinson quote. Which is so
funny
that
Woody Allen used an Emily Dickinson quote to justify his marriage to Sunya.
It made me feel a bit irpy. With you, Claire Dedderer, on that. It's a bit irpy watching Manhattan these days.
But that's the starting point, isn't it? Is that you have to admit, okay, whether I like it or not, something about that work, that person speaks to me. Yeah. And then I have to you can do some work to deconstruct why.
How did you feel after finishing the book? Did you feel, Winnie asked you, like, did you feel, because I don't feel like she offers answers, but how do you feel about Art Monsters now you finished it?
I mean, it was very interesting because, you know, obviously we've been talking about it for a long time. Yeah. So there's a lot of really interesting things she's discovered. Like, it's a bit kind of meandering in that she picks different artists and, like, let's look at how monstrous the art is or not. And I think at the end I did like how she said, like, you know, we can't change what art we love or the person that we love, right? And it's actually almost, there's like a reaffirmation of, like, that love is fine. It's fine that you love Miles Davis, even though he was an abuser and a pimp. It's fine that you love, I don't personally, but, you know, Annie Hall, right? Because there is, the art in itself has an inherent value. And she talks about beauty and, like, the fact that you can connect to it emotionally, even though that creator of that art is a problematic person. that's fine, right? So it's almost kind of like a pardon for the flaws in human behavior. I mean, I don't think at the end of the day she's not like holding up like a standard, you know. I mean, I do think we need to have like a zero tolerance policy in terms of all this kind of behavior in the industries. Otherwise, things aren't going
to
change.
Especially when someone is using their status to continue abusing.
Yeah.
Because the thing we have in comedy with people who continue to work is if you are an employer, you're not going, well, the work's the work. You know, what they say on the panel show, if people enjoy it, it's not just a financial thing. By giving someone status, if they then abuse their status and work are out of it, there does have to be a zero tolerance.
I guess like what's interesting with this book is it's literally called Monsters of Fans Dilemma. So she questions like, you know, is the onus on us as fans to make these moral decisions and like kind of wrestling with yourself, like, can I enjoy this Woody Allen film or not? Right. And she kind of pardons us and says like, if you enjoy the art, you enjoy the art. Right. But then that's a different thing from what we've been talking about, which is about the process of making the art, right? The business of the industry, and like what kind of abusive behavior we're gonna accept and just say that's okay because this person's a genius. So it's almost like there's responsibility. It's probably more responsibility on the end of the producers or you know the industry itself to kind of hold people to account for better behavior, and not actually have the onus put on you know the consumers.
Well,
right?
She's really she says, doesn't she? Like she's speaking on behalf of the audience, and when she says that, she's like, I'm talking on behalf of myself. She's like, I keep saying we. I mean. And I do think this book, why I think it's interesting is it's not offering solutions. It's not coming from producer point of view. It's not coming from like, okay, how do we move forward? How do we create a better working environment? She's like, how do we, the audience, forgive ourselves for these past mistakes, have the art in our life, but also move forward and accept that it's not okay. Like this, and also I think understand the myth of genius, understand the myth of the male artist, and like really like true critic, you know, she deconstructs it, pulls it apart so you can see it for what Picasso was doing, for what Hemingway was doing,
for what Nabokov was writing about.
Oh, we haven't even hit Nabokov.
God.
Jeez.
I love that chapter. That was
my favorite
chapter.
It's her that is her best chapter, definitely. She writes about Nabokov, Lolita, and
an artist being monstrous and demonstrating, I guess, the everyday nature of certain types of monstrousness.
I mean, basically she's saying Nabokov wasn't a monster in his behavior. Nobody knows. I mean, he certainly seemed to be fine, but he was writing a book that made him quite vulnerable in the sense that people could accuse him of being a pedophile, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's a book that, you know, does it glamorize pedophilia? No. She did a very close reading of it and says, like, no, actually, like, you know, what's at the heart of the book is the fact that, you know, and the Lolita character has essentially been erased by
someone who does those kind of things to teenagers or children extinguishes something about them, and that's and that's why it's so unspeakable as a crime. We didn't even speak about that.
I know. I thought oh, we're going to talk about Lolita Page because it's almost that chapter itself is like a book in it.
Yes.
Like it's so much. But I felt she slightly defended him too much for the Nabokov.
But Nabokov's my guy.
Yeah, so that's your guy. I was like, she's defending
him. And I loved Lolita at university. Yeah. I tell you why I loved, and it is a defense, but a little bit like the men who told her she was wrong to not like the film Manhattan because of what it depicts, which is a man who has hebephilic tendencies and power with a much younger woman, but who is, you know, has agency. Mm-hmm. It's what it says about those men, actually, as consumers of work, is that the reason it might be very, very unsettling to a woman who has been a young woman is it feels too true.
Yeah.
And to a man, that's why he relates to the work. That's why he isn't as affronted by it. Mm. It doesn't make him feel physically sick to watch it. And essentially what she said is Nabokov did that on purpose really masterfully. And I was like, phew.
I feel like she slightly got herself into a pretzel knot to get to that point of view. Because the chapter before, she's like, look, Wagner was anti-Semitic and it's not just regardless of the time, he knew what he was doing. And then she's like, but the sexual abuse that he's writing about, it's so happening to everybody that actually Nabokov is kind of doing everyone a favour by writing about it. And I was like, I still think it was wrong and he knew it was wrong and he made a you know, beautifully written book about it. But again, that's the fan. Mm. She's clearly such a huge fan of Nabokov that she is. But that was my one. Yeah. I was like, Claire.
Yeah.
You sound like me defending David Bowie.
I I guess one thing to call into mind is kind of this thing about the single-mindedness of the artist, right? And that's what I did like about her book in terms of, like, by looking at these different artists, she is also kind of discussing, like, how completely single-minded you have to be to pursue your art and just to be like, listen, I don't care. I'm going to maybe treat the people in my personal life a bit shitty because I need to, you know, get this movie done or this book done. And that is, to some extent, that is, as an art, you know, that is what you have to do, like, in some ways. I mean, not treat them badly, but you really have to prioritize your art. Yeah. And if you're creating art at the level of these people, and with that level of frequency, like, you do have to be that single-minded in some ways, right? And so, like in Complicit, there's this, I mean, it doesn't pardon, like, the abusive behavior, but you do have to really kind of prioritize, like, I want to be creating. So in Complicit, there's this director character, Xander, who is completely single-minded to the point that he shows up and he won't do the chit-chat with people. He'll just sit there, you know, with his dark glasses and be like, okay, this is my artistic vision. You help me make it. And to have... Is that ego? Yeah, that's ego, because you have to kind of be so assured about the quality of your own artistic vision and the fact that you deserve, you know, especially in film, it's like, okay, get all these other people to raise millions of dollars to make my artistic vision happen, right? There's, you know, there's a different thing between if you're a writer, you sit down, you write your own work, and like that's it. You're not really like taking up other people's resources.
Amy Schumer's books, I think the first chapter is about how when she goes on tour, she doesn't talk to people who work in the venue because it's exhausting.
Okay. Yeah.
And so she's writing this sort of really... not even defensively, she's just writing, I don't say hello. Basically, she's saying, if you work on stage door and I haven't said hello to you, it's because if I said hello to everyone I didn't know, then by the time I get on stage, I'm depleted. And I read this as someone who does the same job as her and thought, how incredibly rude.
Right.
But she's much more successful than I am. Mm. So maybe if I stopped going, oh, hello, nice to meet you. Do you want anything from the shops? I'm going to the little Sainsbury's. Maybe I'd be a much better comedian and much more famous.
I think it's a really personal thing, and I think some people are like you said, people have spoken about, like, oh, they're so nice, they know everybody's names on set, and they are
Tom Hanks,
and they are able to do that. They are able to be that person and be the artist, and some people aren't. I think it's you know, no shame. Some people just cannot. Hey, how are you? Do that, and then do acting. They're like, I have to be really rude to you and be single-minded.
Yeah,
but it's like, where's the boundary? Where do we blur? Where's this idea of, like, that's someone just being a bit like an asshole and someone being monstrous?
Yeah.
And we know the difference, but we also all have experienced someone who we thought was a bit of an arsehole and turns out they were a fucking monster. You're like, I did think they weren't very nice.
Yeah, it was a warning sign.
Yeah. And so you are not giving warning signs. Maybe that's...
The last line, I actually loved, I really loved how Claire Dedibus started with these two quotes.
Yes, the quotes.
So I thought as our last
from
lines.
From one of my favourites, Shirley Hazzard, who we do not get to speak enough about.
Read out Shirley Hazzard quote, please.
Okay, Carrier. This is a quote from the front of her book by Shirley Hazzard, amazing writer. It is always tempting, of course, to impose one's views rather than to undergo the submission required by art, a submission akin to that of generosity or love.
I think that's so beautiful.
Oh, Hazzard is very beautiful.
And I really love this quote from Clarice Lispector. Who has not asked himself at some time or other, am I a monster or is this what it means to be a person?
Such a good
quote. Because essentially, and that's why I'd really recommend this book to anyone.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
It's like having a really interesting conversation.
So smart. Such a smart
book. Without preaching at you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I felt like I learned a little bit more actually about all of these artists involved, even though they're monsters, the majority of them.
Yeah. And I think it also, if you've ever had a conversation with someone being like, no, but Manhattan's a thing, it gives you a lot of arguments. You're like, no, hang on. Let me tell you why, Mr. Man.
Yeah.
Manhattan is still not okay. It's erpy. So yeah, I loved this book.
It's erpy.
I'm sure Dedera would want us all to take that away. Thank you so much, Rini.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Weirdos Book Club. You can find Winnie on social media, and winniemlee.com, that's li.com, is her website. Go over there and find out about all of her books. Next week's episode is all about what we're looking forward to reading in 2024, that's this year. What's coming up? What are we excited about?
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Thank you for reading with us.
We like reading
with you.
Yeah.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hi, I'm Lucy Beaumont.
And guess what? I'm Sam Campbell.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy our podcast. It's called Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.
We have a podcast and it might be, I probably don't want to sound, you know, like I'm bragging, but it's dynamite. It is electric. It's high voltage. And please, we really need you to listen. You don't understand how much we need this.
Is it on all the platforms?
Oh, it absolutely is. But this one is coming. This one's out now. Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.